Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we have very special guest, Mr. Matt Finch, who we call the godfather of the OSR, and he's going to talk about the 20th anniversary of Osric coming up next year. That's the first edition advanced D&D retro clone, the first retro clone ever, and the new version 3.0 of Osric that's now being crowdfunded. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into the conversation, I will remind everyone, as always, that at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server, available to all our patrons. If you want to join in, you can. Just join our patron at patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any level tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get that all set up during the show, because about 10 minutes afterwards, we'll be on there live to chat with all of you.
We look forward to that. So, Matt, thanks so much for joining us today. And my mind is kind of blown that we are approaching the 20th anniversary of Osric. Time passes so fast. If any of our viewers just don't know what Osric is, maybe tell us is that a character from a Shakespeare play, or what is Osric?
It is a character from a Shakespeare play. It's also the I think it's the King in the Conan movie, but what it stands for in this context is old school rules of violation, which, as Dan mentioned, is a retro clone of first edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, and retro clone meaning that the rules have been rewritten and restated in order to allow third party publishers to use that as a name for it, to get access to, originally it was to get access to the Open Game License. In this version, we're using the Creative Commons license as the inbound license that allows us to use various intellectual property. And then there will be outbound licenses as well for third-party publishers. It's largely to get third-party publishers working on Osric, on first edition Advanced Dungeons & Dragons resources, and being in the license mold to be able to do that. And since one of the recent developments is that the OGL has sort of started to become a little bit shaky, we're moving Osric over to the new license. And the other objective, really the main objective, is to come out with a strong teaching edition that teaches people how to play first edition Advanced D&D, because the earlier edition of Osric wasn't really intended to teach it. It was intended to be a tool for the publishers to use. But, this was way back in 2005. The books were cheap. They were, they were everywhere. But Wizards was not selling them or allowing any PDF access to them. Everybody who was publishing for third edition D&D, which was the current edition at the time, there was a very strong third-party publisher movement. There wasn't for first edition Advanced D&D. So we're kind of doing several different things with this new version of Osric, including actually getting closer to a lot of the AD&D rules, which we were shakier on how exactly to do that with the first version of Osric, because it was the first retro clone that was really trying to duplicate the rules that was ever written. We've got, unfortunately, there are multiple elevator pitches for this thing. So that's actually better to have only one elevator pitch, but the problem here is that we're doing multiple things all at once. So,
I was having a conversation with my partner this morning about, the need, right. And the history of the retro clones. Like, now that we're 20 years out, it's an interesting context to remember. I think that 20 years ago, you couldn't get PDFs of everything, right? Because Wizards was locking that all down. And then I wanted to say, oh, but now you can find PDFs. So now everything's great and sunny and wonderful. But like, is it? I don't know. The OGL nonsense that we just went through, what was that, a year ago or less? You know, who knows? Who knows what kind of legal footing we're going to stand on, and when the original books will just be yanked out from under us again?
Yeah, it's definitely possible. I don't think that's likely, but it is definitely possible.
And the question what do you have to do to actually publish and publicize something that's compatible? And of course, like at this point, hundreds of products have been published that to be compatible with Osric in the first and second editions, which is great. But there's always these, and I think many of us, I mean, obviously Matt has a background in law, so he's, you know, he blazed the path for what seemed to be safe. But, you know, D&D is owned by a very large company. And whatever the phrase is, their idle threat is potentially, if it comes to that, is potentially a much larger risk than what you'd think the actual black letter law says. So yeah. keeping our adventure publications on the safe side of that and showing us how to do that like Matt does is enormous.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got. You know, as you mentioned, there are already probably thousands of resources that were, you know, written for Osric, you know, during the first few years after it originally came out. And part of our goal is to sort of re-energize that segment of the OSR that, you know, tends to be, you know, I think the OSR has sort of focused on simplicity, whereas AD&D, while it is more complex than OD&D and more complex, certainly more complex than BX, you know, the sort of OSE Labyrinth lore type ones, there is a reason for that, which is that, you know, advanced D&D will hold together up to, you know, 20th level. You're just not going to have the kind of occasionally screwy result that you can get, you know, using BX or even OD&D, which, you know, and I'm an OD&D player. So, you know, there is a virtue to some of the crunchiness. The problem is, of course, that when they wrote that crunchiness, it was across three books. It was the first time that, you know, anyone had ever written a role-playing game. It was done without a computer, so once something was typed, you had a real sense of "let's not change this."
Good.
So, you know, one of the factors in AD&D is that it appears to be a lot more complicated than it is, and that's just because of the presentation that, you know, the player is reading it here, but over here the DM has got some additional rules that nowadays you'd absolutely put in the player facing book. You know, here are the to hit rolls for your character. You know, here are the saving throw rolls for your character. And Gygax also had a tendency to fix corner cases wherever he happened to be in the document. And so you would get this sort of offhanded comment here that actually speaks to something that was already talked about somewhere else. And so one of the things that we're working on doing here, and it was done in Osric 1 and 2, but, you know, more focusing on it here, is drawing together the things that belong together and putting them in one place. And we're still doing a lot of cross-referencing because, an entangle spell is going to need its description of what that does. But we are also putting in a section of conditions. And so, you know, there's entangle. They entangled there, and the reason it's there is because that condition can actually apply to certain, you know, snake constricting somebody. But really, the, you know, and AD&D is not driven on a concept of conditions the way that later books are, but it's still very helpful as a reference tool. If you're not in the right section, to be able to go to the thing. And also, interestingly, I discovered it's kind of a good quick survey course, because I've got, you know, right at the moment, there's a condition of unhelm, which addresses the fact that there is a very small corner rule in AD&D that if you are not wearing a helmet and you're attacked by an intelligent creature, there is a, I think it's a 10% or it might be 1 in 6 chance that the attack is going to come inbound to your unarmored head rather than to your regular armor class. And so that is in one of the conditions of unhelmed. And so, you know, there's a lot of organizational, you know, decisions that we're sort of still making at this point, because we're still working on breaking out the rules into more granularity to be more easily learned. So it's still a work in progress, even though we've got, you know, a draft. But I want really far afield on that answer. What was the question I was answering?
I have to be the guy that says, well, actually, Matt, for intelligent opponents, it's 3 and 6 if they'll hit you in the head, and for unintelligent, it's 1.
Okay. Very fair.
When we look it up, I'm pretty sure that's what we'll see. Oh God, I hate that guy. I hate that guy that I just played it, that I just play acted. You know, I sometimes find now that, you know, enough time has gone by that I have to actually explain what, you know, what AD&D or Advanced Dungeons and Dragons means to players that weren't there. But it's simply the first edition of what we know as D&D today. And so it's the first time that a role-playing game came out in hardcover books, the whole idea that they were going to print 3 separate hardcover books. And you know, basically those rules have evolved to the D&D that we get published nowadays. And the other thing at the time that was tricky, you're talking about how it was printed, is that it was such a massive undertaking to make hardcover books for an RPG that they could only produce 1 per year. So the whole sequence of Monster Manual came out in 77, which itself was largely a compilation of stuff that came before, and then the Player's Book in 78, and then the DM's Guide in 79, that's a 3-year sequence from start to finish. And there were changes being made in the DM's Guide. So I look at the DM's Guide section that has this whole extra section on spells as basically errata that Gary had come up with since he first published the Player's Handbook. And it is very awkward. And I continually forget about there was some note on a spell that was printed in a different book that I have to remember to go up and check on. So having that stuff more concisely compiled is a big, and just fundamentally edited at once is a huge benefit.
Yeah. I mean, I think the largest one, you know, in terms of clarification is the initiative system, which is described in more than one place. And because of that, there are actual ambiguity, you know, literal ambiguities. You can read this 2 different ways. Resulting from the multiple presentations of initiative.
Let me throw up a question here. Our viewer Vino Azel was asking about exactly this a couple minutes ago, was saying, important questions only, how will Osric 3.0 be handling AD&D initiative? Just kidding, but not really.
I mean, that's probably one of the most valid questions. If you've seen Osric 2.0, you've already got a general idea of how it's done. They're probably one of the bigger differences. For anyone who is not familiar already with Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, the initiative system is very difficult to follow because it's divided up into segments, which are officially 6 seconds in time, but they're not really 6 seconds in time, because what it really is a matter of establishing the order in which things happen. And if you don't need to be using those segments, then you're supposed to just disregard the initiative section. And there is, if you have a tie, you go to a subsystem. So there is a literal ambiguity about whether a spellcaster begins casting their spell at the beginning of the round or whether they begin casting it at the when it comes to their initiative segment, which you're not using if you don't need it. But if you're so that it's largely resolved in Osric 2, you know, there's room to disagree, but the way that it works is first of all, AD&D initiative is unlike later forms of initiative, although you can do it this way, there are 10 segments in a round, but you roll a d6 to find out when you're going. Now, according to official AD&D, you're actually rolling a D6 for the other side so that high is good. And we're flipping that back around because it's very, very counterintuitive. And the people who already know it can do it whichever way. But it's really just a matter of 2 dice are rolled. You can decide which hand rolled which dice. There is literally no change to the rule. It's just a question of whose hand rolls the die. So the way that it's described in 3.0 is that, you know, you roll the dice and then that's the segment in which you are going in your initiative round. Actually, I have to step back, because before any of that happens, you have to declare what you're doing. Features of AD&D is that you have to declare what you're going to be doing before the initiative roll, so that you don't know, you can't game your answer about what you're going to be doing based on whether you get a good or bad initiative. So, you know, you get the thing about, you know, we're going to close into combat, we're going to charge into combat, I'm going to be casting a spell, what spell is it going to be? And so all of that's sort of done first. Then you roll this d6. And you may ask yourself, if there are 10 segments, why are we only rolling a d6? A lot of people do roll a d10. However, there is an answer as to why you roll a d6, which is that that makes it more likely that you're going to have a situation where if there's an enemy spellcaster, that you're going to be able to interrupt their spell by compacting everything into only 6 of the segments rather than using the whole 10. And this is why it's kind of abstract. It's not really a 6-second, 6-second, 6-second. It's really just determining the order, and then, you know, all of the people actions happen in the first 6 rounds, and then the rest of it is just to tally out the count on spell casting time. This is probably sounding, again, you know, it all sounds more complicated than it is. So you say what you're going to do, you roll a d6, you go in whichever segment it is that shows on the d6. If you're firing missile weapons, you may be going a little bit before. But we are shifting it a little bit more toward the mode of, it is a bit like a war game, therefore you are declaring your actions before you go, and the whole side goes at once. And then, of course, there is the optional rule of just rolling, you know, sort of more like what was done in second edition. You just roll a d10, your character goes whenever their time comes up. And that creates its own type of wargamey chaos, because always someone is going to win initiative, do something stupid. Everyone's going to say, no, don't do that. And then you're like, nope, you already did it. So there's chaos in either of the two systems. But we did want to, like I said, you know, bring it back to letting, you know, newer gamers who never played a pre-2000 version of D&D to see how this is how it really was officially. And then here are some of the things that a lot of people did, you know, either later or even at the time, to get a different type of result. So that is the answer on initiative, is that we're going a little bit more back to the official. The way in which we're going back to the official is that it is wargaming. It's the declare action. It's the side all goes simultaneously. Spellcasting does begin only at the spellcaster's initiative, but since the other side does not have to go in their segment, you can always, you know, initiative is only the first chance you get to respond. You don't have to do your thing in that segment. So if you are in melee combat with a spellcaster, all that happens is you're going to wait and attack them when they begin casting the spell, and then potentially interrupt. And that's part of the reason for using the d6 instead of the d10 to resolve it. So there is a probably longer than desired answer about how we're going to be doing initiative. But it's very close to what it was in Osric too. There are a few shifts toward back to, you know, official AD&D rules, but it's still basically the same concept.
Interesting. Maybe tell us a little bit more for folks that are want to either experience what you know, fully featured D&D was like at the outset, or are DMs that want to get their players playing with Osric type rules. What are some of the other ways that you've been focused on making this one easier to learn for new people?
Well, easier to learn, I mean, there are still sort of broad brushstroke answers to that, because I'm in the process, right? Well, part of it, let me go back to the beginning of answering that question and start over. Number one is that we are taking things that were wall of text in Osric. People read differently now than they did in 2005. And especially since we're targeting, you know, people who've never played a pre-2000 game, the assumption is that they are younger and have done more of their, you know, reading on the internet. And frankly, you know, even, you know, people my age are beginning to read differently because of reading mostly on screens. And the way in which we read differently is that there is much less mental tolerance for a large paragraph of text, because we're trained to look at the beginning of something, to look for bullet points or subheadings, and then move on. So when you see a wall of text, you're generally only going to really capture the first couple of sentences of that and the last sentence of that, and not much in between. So the approach number one is that when we're talking about rules, we're trying to granulate them more, either with subheadings, with bullet points, or just with a new line of text to break the rules down so that that something that is an actual, you know, wargamey type rule is going to be very clearly stated rule by rule, is number one. And then number two is more examples, because when we did Osric 2, you know, back in 2005, our real audience was mainly third-party publishers or people who wanted to play AD&D, but the books were getting expensive, but they'd already played it before. They already knew how to play. What they wanted was a reference book to look up the rule, because as we've talked about, some of them are difficult to remember because they're from different places. So they're just including more examples is another thing that will help. And then eventually I'll probably also be writing some walkthrough text of, you know, if you are reading this for the first time, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the people who are just using it as a reference will see if you are reading this for the first time or playing this game for the first time, and they'll skip right onto the next section. But those three things, the sort of walking you into what you're reading or what you're about to read, having the rules broken out in more granular format, either for reference or for learning, and then thirdly, the examples to clarify, you know, exactly how some of these granular rules actually look when they're being played. So that's the... Nice. And what tripped me up when I first started answering that question was talking about the walkthrough text, which is not, you know, I haven't gotten to that yet because I'm still breaking stuff out into the granular rules.
Okay.
And working on the examples. And I realized I'm describing this process back to front. So that's...
Let me, I'm wondering, you know, I sympathize with this trajectory of, at the outset, the first time you did Osric, of making some stuff that was notably, including some stuff that was notably different than the rule set that you were trying to echo. And then over time, bringing it back, partly for legal confidence reasons, bring it back closer and closer over time, because I have a small product that I maintain called the OED Book of Spells, a much smaller, much allegedly simpler product that replicates just the magic user spells in original D&D. And I, you know, I've been drafting my third edition for that, and I've been finding myself doing the exact same thing, is that stuff where I was taking the OGL text about 20 years ago initially. I feel like I have the opportunity to go in and rewrite that to be more close, even closer to the original rules than I did to begin with. So I find that for the exact same reasons. So it's interesting that you're saying that today. What are some other notable places where you found an opportunity to get closer to actual advanced D&D in this edition?
Oh, well, there's a couple of major ones. I mean, I think I've worked a way of having a monk character class in there, which at the time we were like, God, there's no way you can do this, because so much of it is, you know, sort of more story than it is rules. And what we're doing with the monk is it's, you know, some people will not like it because it is killing two birds with one stone, because it is a variant. But the problem everyone had with the monk was the fact that it was tremendously overpowered, and that you could only ever play one if you had tremendously good stats. That's how they did the balancing back at the time.
So
the thing was, if you did get those stats, you were gold. You could play a monk, and if you managed to have it survive through third level, where it was likely to die, after that, you had a super overpowered character. Modern, you know, I hesitate to say modern because I don't think games evolved, but that's one method of balancing that I don't think is terribly productive. It certainly is balancing. But what I think everyone would rather have is that, look, if I like this concept, I would like to be able to have a chance of possibly playing it. And I'm also fine not having an absolutely, you know, overpowered character, because what I really want to do is sort of be this type of a, you know, whether, you know, and it doesn't matter whether you're a rulesy gamer or a role-playing gamer, because it's still, I want to play this particular set of tactical options, or I want to play this sort of story, you know, role in the story. So what we did with the monk was, it's a little bit similar to what was done in third edition, which was simply, okay, here are your minimum stats, the original minimums, the real high ones. But some of your abilities are contingent on, and you no longer really have those. You've got a much lower set of minimums that are more in accordance with the other character classes, of being able to have a monk. But if you have a monk, but it doesn't have the super high dexterity, then you're not actually able to use some of the higher dexterity skills.
Okay.
So that you can have a monk that doesn't have all of the monk abilities. They've only got the ones where they met the original stat minimums. And that still leads to like a five pages worth of describing the character class. But we were able to get that one in. So, you know, that's it is certainly closer to AD&D in the sense that there is a monk class, which Osric II did not have. And that monk class has got a numerical rules profile that is very, very similar to the AD&D monk. But the way it operates is a little bit different. So that's large answer number one as to how are you getting closer to AD&D. Large answer number two is that is a bit similar to the monk. We are putting in an unarmed combat subsystem that has overbearing and grappling in it. Presented in a way that's similar to the DMG thing. You can do a fending off roll. And I realize when I start talking about things like fending off rolls, probably a lot of people, you know, even the ones who use that system didn't notice that sentence. You know, this is one of those type of things. But, you know, you've got a fending off roll, you know, overbearing. You can potentially knock somebody down. You can potentially keep them down. You know, grappling, you've got, you know, this hold, but if you roll higher, then you replace it with your hold. So it's a fairly complex subsystem. But again, I think that people who really want to be as close to AD&D as possible without necessarily going right back to the original books, that's a usable subsystem. And then there are lots and lots of little things where we're going closer. I mean, in Osric II, it was missing the dexterity-based saving throw against an aimed magic item. So that's back in many, many little things like that. Some of the class skills match more closely with the numbers. I mean, one of the things is just that when we first wrote Osric, we weren't sure numbers. Are they, you know, is it copyright? Is it, or is it not copyrightable? And I think the answer with the game mechanics really is that, you know, numbers pretty much are going to be considered game mechanic and something that is fair use. So some of just the number things are a little bit closer.
Got it.
Yeah, and I could go on with a long, long list of stuff that's getting back to AD&D, but it's going to be a long list of fairly trivial things that most people are not interested in, other than the fact that, you know, yes, there is a monk, yes, there is an unarmed combat system. Those are probably big enough to be worth mentioning, but the rest of it is a lot of little stuff.
There's a conversation in the chat right now with Arn Man and some other people about the specific volume of the fireball spell, and it's very close to my heart, but I'm fighting my own tendency to actually not talk about that, because I totally, he's Greg, great point there. But the thing we should mention, you're talking about the monk, that brings up the next question would be the other class in first edition that's even harder to get into and requires even higher ability scores and is even more overpowered when you get there. And that's namely the Bard, which in first edition was restricted to an optional appendix. Did that make the cut or too hard to fit in?
that was too hard to fit in a way that we felt like, you know, we were like, okay, for Monk, you know, you've got this idea, you know, here's something that's close enough to AD&D, that it'll be workable, the numbers work out well, this is something that we can add in. Here's the problem with the Bard. You have got two completely separate circles in a Venn diagram that does not connect in terms of how a Bard ought to work. It's either got to be the dual class advancement, and then you don't actually become a Bard at high level, or screw that, I want to be a Bard starting at first level and work my way up with, you know, some mix of the characteristics of those classes, and why would I ever want to play the thing? And there is no separation in those. So you are going to piss off half of the people who read the book, guaranteed, depending on how you do it in there. So, you know, the thing is that, you know, we've started talking about, you know, maybe it really does make sense to come out with something later on that's kind of like the Book of Options that we did for Swords and Wizardry, where we do, you know, here is your split Bard class, and here is your unified Bard class. Pick whichever one you want. You know, it's a resource. And, you know, because we've had a bunch of, you know, a lot of second edition players wanting, you know, non-weapon proficiencies to see that. That's not going to be in there, but that would be something that could go. So, you know, we're starting to talk about possibly there's a book like that in the future. But the answer on the Bard is no, we're just not going there with the Bard. We're just going to leave it out because no one's going to be or half of people will be.
It wasn't a core class.
Right.
It wasn't a core class in first edition, so that makes a lot of sense.
Let me jump in here and ask, you know, Dan didn't want to go all the way into like volumetric fireballs, but I think that conversation originated with talks about scale. And I noticed in your backer kit that you are including official VTT support. So I'm kind of curious in like how you approach that, and did it force you to resolve some of the scale issues?
Yeah, great.
Okay, it's actually a fairly complicated answer to that because there are two there are two different kinds of VTTs out there. There are the ones that, the one that we're going to be putting this into has already got a very, very strong VTT application for Osric 2, which will be forked. And Osric 3 will continue to be supported, and Osric 2 will still be out there for free, but, you know, it will, given the way that VTTs work, it will slowly become probably less usable, but it might be usable for, you know, years and years. When the VTT is doing it for you in that system, so the Foundry VTT is going to be very accurate toward regular D&D. The other type of VTT that people are using is one where you throw in your own map and it doesn't really do very much for you. It's just allowing you to talk, you know, with the players. And another thing that's happening there is that a lot of the maps that people are grabbing are from later editions and therefore much smaller scale than what a classic AD&D map would look like. And so one of Stuart's things that he did was to develop a VTT scale. And we're not putting that into the book because it would be a tremendous change to the rules to say, here is a scaled down version. You know, I think a lot of people would react to that like, well, that's not really advanced D&D at all because you've changed away around the way that turns work. You've changed a lot of the scales. There's too many changes, but what we are going to work on doing is along with that, VTT implementation, which really does it for you very, very well. And we know that because we've seen it already. It's already in operation for us too. In addition to that, we're going to probably send out a PDF that is all of Stuart's VTT scale movement things and say, here is a bunch of movement scales and also spell effect scales that you can refer to if you want to scale down, if you want to play small AD&D as opposed to big AD&D. And that should help. And it's less ideal for the people who are using, you know, the Owlbear sort of implementation with a modern map to have it there instead of in the book. But I think that the Owlbear implement, you know, first of all, you know, Owlbear's fine if you're using a real AD&D map. It's really only if you're using something that limits the size of your map, and you are using a modern map. And that was a little bit too many steps to put it in the book. So that is a plan. We haven't actually mentioned that, I don't believe, anywhere in the backer kit thing itself. And that's just because I haven't even started on the thing. Stuart is still working on magic user spells. But eventually the goal is to come out with something that is like it's either a guide to VTT, which says, you know, here's how you go on Foundry, and here is the small scale AD&D movement rates, or just something that's small scale D&D, you know, small scale AD&D. If you want to play it, you know, and you've got a small map, you can use all of these movement scales to play it on a sort of shrunken down level. But it does a lot of stuff, because as Paul pointed out, it's not just movement, it's also spell effects. So it really sort of creates an entirely new smaller scale system. But that is how we are planning on helping the fact that there are really two different types of VTTs. And we'll see, you know, I've got a sense, and a lot of people tend to think that the more interactive ones that do more of the thinking for you are probably likely to supplant the simpler version side. But I also happen to really like simple technology. So, you know, we're going to try and back both of those for now.
Nice. Now, you're mentioning Stuart, and of course, that's Stuart Marshall, who was a co-creator with Matt here of the original Osric. He was in second edition, he was listed as editor-in-chief. So it appears that he took kind of the lead for second edition, and now you're coming back together in third, which is great to see. I will say on the scales issue, and it's something that I feel anytime I say this to anybody, it's their reaction is like I just read something out of the Necronomicon, is that I say, well, you know, in first edition, the scales are actually listed in inches, and the inches in the spells and movement mean different things indoors or outdoors. That some of us have been chatting about. An inch is 10 feet indoors, it's 10 yards outdoors. But on top of that, at the start of the DM's guide, where it's talking about maybe you want to use miniatures, it says if you're using miniatures on an actual table, 1 inch should represent 3 1/3 feet. So you technically have to take,
yeah,
right. So you have to do a double conversion of like it says inches, which means 30 feet, which means it's actually. I can't even do that.
Well, I mean, what you do
is 30 inches on the table.
What you do is, you know, you on your battle mat, you just do it. You know, it's actually that a 10-foot square is. 3 by 3 by 3 block of things, and the reason for that is that
there
are things having to do with, you know, I'm pointing a spear in between two of my, you know, nearby people. But, you know, and one way you can do that on most VTTs is that you nowadays define the scale of the thing, and you can actually basically redraw squares. So, you know, if you have something that's in 10-foot squares, just add in a whole set of smaller ones, and you can do it that way. But, you know, there are probably some people out there who are like, ah, yes, I know exactly why it's 3 1/3. And there's another group of people who are like, why in the hell would you do 3 1/3 for the, you know, probably just let that drop at the moment, because, you know. The reason is, just so for anyone who doesn't know why you would use 3 1/3, it's simply the rules for AD&D talk about being able to have three people standing next to each other within a 10-foot. Within a 10-foot area, and that's why you would break it down into the 3-man front.
That was the custom. That was the custom.
Which was the style.
Thank you for finding us, Armin. I guess I should. So you got a number of different print options for this that are being planned. Which, and I guess I was a little bit unclear. How are these things actually going to get printed physically?
Okay, well, I mean, our original plan was that we were going to do something that was an oblong size book, you know, so, you know, a little wider than West Hall. And the reason for that being that, you know, number one, Osric has a lot of really wide tables that will show better on a wider page. But also there's the ongoing discussion about books lying flat. The people who like the spiral bound, can I get a spiral bound version of this thing so that I can open it up and lay it flat? And we were like, well, okay, yeah, but the spiral bound people and the good binding people, once again, to a Venn diagram that looks like a double zero, the, you know, I am in the group that likes, you know, books with nice bindings on the shelves. So this was like, okay, well, here's a halfway mark between lying flat and having a very good binding, is that a book that is wider than it is tall is going to lie flat a lot easier than a regular, you know, portrait bound book. So those landscape ones, we had a bunch of people ask, you know, hey, can you do a portrait, you know, oriented version of that? And, you know, it was enough people that were like, okay, we'll go ahead and do a print run of the portrait size ones as well. Because Susie was like, yeah, it'll take time, but it's probably not going to cause too much trouble. You know, it's certainly a different layout for those books. But one of the things that we're doing in Osric is that we're using section numbers for a lot of the rules. So that if you've got two different versions, you can still refer precisely to which rule you're talking about by talking about the section number rather than the page number. So we're like, okay, well, it's already basically planned in a way that this will work. So the answer to the question, what they're going to be, is that the landscape option, offset printed, portrait version, also offset printed. You know, it's going onto a printing press. It's going to be, you know, very, very high quality, you know, binding. It's going to have the, you know, sewn binding. So those are, you know, equivalent highest quality thing. There's also a print on demand version, which is a compiled, both of them in one. Again, that's more geared toward people who are not in the USA, so that if some sort of tariff calamity happened mid-funding, that people would be able to switch to something that was being printed for them outside of the USA. Plus, a lot of people do like a one version thing. That print-on-demand version is a soft cover. The reason for that is that it is a glued binding, and glued bindings work much better on soft covers than they do on hard covers, and it's going to be a pretty thick book, so that's an issue. And I realize that there's a whole lot of people who are like, well, why can't it be a hardcover? And it's kind of like, because there are going to be some physical problems with some of those books. Some of them will be fine, but guaranteed some of them are going to, you know, get delivered and crack instantly if it's a hardcover, and some will if it's a soft cover too. But, you know, it's, you're limited to the choices that are there, and you can't have a million different choices. I mean, you know, certainly profit wise,
like, we're taking a lot of work. It's a lot of work just for the ones that you're describing already.
Well, plus by having two different options means that we're doing two different print runs rather than a combined print run, which means that the unit cost of the books is actually going to be higher than it would have been if we combined those into one print run. So we also, you know, kissed away some of the profit by making that option available. But our real goal with this Kickstarter is to bring Osric back into the realm of, you know, people providing resources for it. You know, we're trying to expand the reach of Osric to both third party publishers, you know, younger gamers. It's to publicize the edition. So the amount of profit, granted, I want to get money back. I don't want to lose money on the thing, but the you know, maximizing profit is not the primary goal here. So we decided, yeah, okay, well, we'll go ahead and do two different, because, you know, we're still pretty convinced that people are really going to like those landscape books, but, you know, we'll see.
Nice. Speaking of the tables, you know, you and I cycled a little bit a couple months ago. Do you still have the traditional first edition big tables for attacks and saves, or is there an option to just use a formula now, or have you switched?
Well, for the one of the options that we're doing in here is the option to have ascending armor class, talking about pulling in people who haven't played in a pre-2000 D&D. Descending armor class, which we're all familiar with, is completely senseless to people who have begun later in the game. They just cannot understand why you would ever use descending armor class. And we all can probably talk the reasons, usually less math, blah, blah, blah. But so we're going to have descending armor class is still going to be the default for it, because, like I said, we are trying to show people these are the rules of, you know, first edition advanced D&D. And those need tables, So, you know, there are going to be all of this, the standard charts. And even the Ascending Armor class, I think, will be showing on those tables. But one of the things, one of the reasons why younger gamers like Ascending Armor class is that you can use it in a formula where the armor class of the creature is your target number to hit. And therefore, you don't even need a chart. You know, is it armor class 10? I need a 10 to hit. To make that work, you do have to give each character class and every monster a base attack bonus that brings the die roll to the appropriate place for working on the chart. So for descending armor class, there is not a formula. There's going to be the charts. For the ascending armor class option, you can either look at the table or you can add the base armor. You can go to that section that says, here's how you do it. Here's how you do the secret formula. Here are your base attack numbers. Add these in. Don't use the tables or you're giving yourself an extra bonus that you have a right to. But if you're doing it that way, then the armor class of the creature will be your target number. So it's going to be isolated in a section for people who want to see how it would work with the ascending armor class. And yes, it will have that formula in there. And the only screwy thing is that if you roll a natural 20, you have to add, I think it's a +5 to your natural 20. And that's to get you past the fact that in AD&D, that attack table goes, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, all works great. 20 fails, 20 fails, 20 fails, 20 fails. 21. Now we're back on the system. So you do have to have that extra rule for what you do if you roll a natural 20 that you added. But it either does nothing because you already hit, or it makes it work with AD&D.
I cannot resist saying,
if you weren't one of the hosts on this show, Dan, I wouldn't even have bothered saying those details. But I knew your first question out there. If I neglected to mention that +5 rule, the next question is going to be, well, in that case, how are you dealing with the way that it does it?
I was just giving an opportunity. You know, it wasn't mandatory, Matt. I was just giving an opportunity. That, for what it's worth, that was the thing that Matt and I cycled on a couple months ago about what would be a good idea there. What I will add is I can't resist saying that if viewers want an additional option, I for quite a while, I have what I refer to as the Target 20 system you could look up online, in which you have descending armor class. And that's just used as an added bonus. So whatever the opponent's armor class is, you add that to your formula-based roll. And I know some people use that, and some people do like that. And folks can look that up online as Target 20 if you want to see something kind of in between. If you want the compromise option in between the two things that Matt was just talking about, that probably makes a lot of people unhappy. But that's it's one thing you could consider.
You know, absolutely. I mean, it did cross my mind the fact that, you know what, if I've got a formula for ascending, that implies that there is a formula for descending as well. But I think, you know, most of the people who play using descending armor class, they're either trained for THACO, in which case they'll do it that way, or they just look at a chart. So.
I mean, for what it's worth, what I just described is how I've been doing it since the 90s, and I tend to be kind of Johnny Appleseed with that. But as we know, it's mathematically equivalent, effectively. Do you still... Okay, now this... I apologize to everybody involved. Paul, Matt, everybody watching.
This is going to be a good one.
What's your rule for falling damage, Matt? Do you use the cumulative damage, or is it just linear?
I roll 1d6 per 10 feet.
And not cumulatively?
Not cumulatively.
Okay, now that would be a change from second edition. Osric.
Well, you asked what I use. Oh, you mean what's being used in here? It's the same.
Yeah,
no, we're not making it. As far as I know, we're not making a change from Osric 2 to Osric 3 on that. Okay. We're just going with whatever it is in Osric 2.
Okay, okay. I like how you play it. I hear that. Interesting. Okay. Because that was a rule, that cumulative damage was a rule that was asserted in Unearthed Arcana. It doesn't quite match up with what came before. So interesting. Interesting. I forgive you. It's okay.
Before we run out of time, Matt, I wanted to touch a little bit on the licensing stuff. Because this is the snafu with around OGL is something we covered earlier on the show, and so that definitely jumped out at me when I was looking at your backer kit. Is the moving away from OGL? So I was curious if you could talk a little bit about what your reasoning behind that is, and what you're moving to.
Well, the reasoning behind moving off the OGL is that a lot of the, Wizards of the Coast certainly thinks that they can cancel the OGL or that they would like to. And they tried that and they had it pointed out to them that they couldn't do that. But a lot of the legal defenses against that is something that's called reliance damage. That if you said a thing, which they did, about not being able to cancel it, that then they wouldn't be able to cancel it. But now their most recent position is that it can be canceled, and so therefore one has less ability to use reliance damage. And plus, the whole way through, they've pretty much had the ability to, although they couldn't cancel the OGL, what they could do would be to cut off any new people from accepting the offer that is contained in the open license. So you can't in any way affect the people who have already signed on. You can't do a thing about it, but you can pretty much turn off the tap on new things. And when they finally think of that, they'll probably try doing it that way. Whereas what they have, however, done is put a couple of the fifth edition editions into the Creative Commons license, which is, that's pretty much bulletproof. They're not going to be able to get that back out again. So that's a reliable thing. And it's also easier to use than the OGL, because all that you have to do to access that is to include a paragraph in there with the link, basically. There's some required language you put in there. But it's way less than retyping the whole OGL in there. It's a little inconvenient if you wanted to do your own publication through the Creative Commons license and still maintain, trademarks and so on and so forth, because you have to actually put an SRD out there. So okay, what we're doing to support third-party publishers is two things. I mean, one of them we did with Swords and Wizardry, which was to generate the ELF license, AELF license, which is basically a duplication of the open game license, only fixed to be permanent. And we thought, okay, that's going to be great because everyone's familiar with the open game license. But with any changes to it, and the fact that people are now rapidly becoming less familiar with the open game license, we're discovering that people are looking at the ELF license and saying, well, it's too hard because they're maybe less familiar. It would have been easy. You just did the same exact stuff you did with the OGL, but you do it here with different words. But, we're finding that people are having some trouble with that. So we are going to release Osric 3 with the ELF license, so basically a duplicate of the open game license. But we're also going to do something that is way more limited, but way easier to use, which is modeled after Kelsey's Shadowdark license, because we have seen people are really good at using the Shadowdark license. They understand it, they grok it, they can use it. But it only gives you really access to using spells, monsters, a lot of the rule stuff. You can't duplicate word for word in your own thing. But for doing modules and things like that, it works great. So we're also going to be giving people the ability to publish under that sort of thing, because if you're trying to do a module, this lets you get to it. Now, the downside of that is that we're not nudging people who are using that licensing mode. We're not nudging them toward building up open game content out there for other people to use, which is a downside, because it is nice to have a whole bunch of open game content out there. But if people are shying away from releasing something at all because they don't understand the license, it's better to go ahead and have them get it out there in some form or other, and then later they can figure out, here's a way that you can make this open game content. There's multiple different ways of doing that. So I think that overall, even though it is more restrictive, overall, you know, and we're going through so many sea changes in terms of intellectual property and licensing and stuff right now that, you know, when it all shakes out toward the end and things stabilize with WOTC and, you know, Creative Commons license and OGL and so on and so forth, hopefully we end up with more open game content by having facilitated publishing than we would have by saying you can't publish unless you're doing it.
Fascinating. Huh. Thanks for educating us about that.
Well, I don't think it's stuck with anybody, but you know, there's probably a few people. It made perfect sense, Finch, but you know, normally when I go into legal mode and don't have a chance to, you know, cross out I think and run on sentences with parentheses and M dashes, and that's the problem for getting it across to anybody.
I mean, we're just very fortunate to have you thinking about this stuff, Matt, because that's, you know, we all watched the OGL stuff go down when they tried to yank it, and it was, frankly, a little terrifying. So,
yeah, I think everyone's really scared.
On behalf of the community, thank you, sir.
Well put. Agreed. Super well put.
Here, you know, I'm going to throw one thing up here. Nope, we're out of time. Sorry, Dan.
Let me throw one. I'm just showing a chat. And it came up at the top. It was Mark CMJ Clover saying, Lake Geneva Games loves carrying Matt Finch offerings. Mark, thanks so much for checking in today.
Thanks very much. Yeah, we brought some stuff over there right after GaryCon. So,
fantastic.
Anybody wants a copy of Tome of Adventure Design, head on over to Lake Geneva Games and grab a copy. They've got them, I believe.
Excellent. Fantastic book. Well endorsed here on Wandering DMs. You see us pull that out actually quite frequently on our Dungeon Design Dash section. Matt, we are out of time. Is there anything about Ozark 3 that you want to get out there that we missed today?
No, I think we covered it all really pretty much. I mean, the biggest thing that people are, you know, a little unclear about is, you know, what am I getting if I get this format? You know, it's all offset except for the print-on-demand version of it. You're getting the highest quality stuff. So,
great.
And thank you very much for the show. I wish I could be on the Discord after. I usually go on the Discord after with your Patreons, but this time my mom's coming over, so I'm going to...
That takes priority.
We'll forgive you this time. Viewers, please check out the links in the description of the YouTube video to get onto the backer kit before it ends. I think as we're recording this today, there are 10 days left. So hop on, check out the link in the description, and get on board for Ozark 3.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub, a bunch of places like that. We do have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites, so please look for us there and regenerate that like button.
Viewers, if you prefer to listen to our show on audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com and also through various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those other third-party carriers and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And you'll see that every one of our tiers gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation continues around the clock, including our live video after chat that Paul talked about. We'll be there in about 10 minutes to get your additional ideas about memories of first edition AD&D and how you've used Ozric and things like that. And we want to hear from you. So just like Paul said, we've got a link to the backer kit for Ozric 3.0. It is already well-funded. We know that Matt is committed to this happening. It's going to occur. So you should jump on board and become a backer as well. And Matt, thank you so much for taking time out to tell us about Ozric today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Fantastic. Hopefully we can get you back again sometime. I'm oh, hoping. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah, don't forget, viewers, we are live. We, definitely so, for all of us, yeah. Don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, so please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.